It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later this hour, we'll talk to WPR's Assistant News Director Noah Ovshinsky to get a roundup of the week's top state news.
We'll also talk to NPR's music guy Stephen Thompson about top summer songs.
But first, a look at the news that Wisconsin prison guards voted to break with the major state employees union.
The guards voted Thursday to separate from the once powerful Wisconsin State Employees Union, and they created a new union known as the Wisconsin Association for Correctional Law Enforcement.
The union represents 5,900 state and security and public safety workers, a big chunk of the over 20,000 members who belong to the State Employees Union before Act 10 outlawed most state employee collective bargaining and made union membership voluntary. Frank Emspach joins us now. He's executive producer of Workers Independent News. Frank, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, were you surprised by this news that the prison guards broke off and formed their own union?
Well, I wouldn't say a surprise. The campaign has been going on for some time, and I asked some people last week what they thought. And at that time, they said they thought it would be a close vote, but I thought, but they basically believed that the WSCU would maintain its majority. And, you know, and it isn't that much of a difference, 300, 400 here out of several thousand. But I think it's what it really means is that you have a continuing disintegration of a unified voice for public sector employees, and I'm not sure that's going to help anybody.
What were the reasons for the prison employees to leave the bigger union?
Well, I don't have any inside information. Wouldn't want to try to speak for the prison guards, but for some time now, let's try it this way. The governor, when he introduced Act 10 in the first place, said, look, you know, I think that protective services are different. And he carved out the police and the firefighters, basically. And clearly, prison guards are in protective services. So he was directly angling to try to cause dissension by saying, you know, you guys are a little different. And some of the prison guards said, okay, we are, and basically began suggesting to the leadership of WSCU that had the WSU been a little bit easier on the governor and this and that, that maybe things wouldn't have been so tough on them, and that maybe the prison guards would have been treated differently. And that is a persuasive argument when you're under attack and getting your head beaten in. And clearly the law made it very, very difficult, makes it basically eviscerates unions. And so some people could say, okay. And then secondly, there's always, in a period of downturn, there's always dissension. I mean, you know, people's standard of living is dropping, and so that's not a good thing. And so people say, what are we going to do, and react. So I think there's those types of issues, and I suspect that what's going to happen here, I mean, you can't predict, you'll have the Wisconsin Association of Correctional Law Enforcement, but under the state law, there has to be a recertification of under the new state law of this organization, and unlike a vote where of those who vote you have to have a majority, in this case 2,600 people voted more or less, in the new election you have to have a majority of all 5,900 people in the bargaining unit. In other words, you got to get 3,000 votes, which is more than the total number of people that voted in this election. So this is a pretty risky thing for the Wisconsin Association. But by and large, it is part of a disintegration, in a certain sense, of a unified voice for public sector workers.
So you're saying it's possible that in 3 months, this recertification vote could fail and we go from this splinter union and then they have no union after that?
Yeah, it's possible. Because the state law says to recertify, you have to have a majority of all those working in the defined unit. And according to the state, there's about 5,900 people involved in the unit, and the total number of votes in this election was 1548 and 1108, so that's 2656, right? So in order for the election to be recertified, in order for this union to be recertified, they're going to have to get about 3,000 votes. It's more than who voted in the entire thing, and that is going to be very difficult.
So that's
they could go from the frying pan into the fire here. Absolutely.
That's the future of this new correctional workers union. Now let's look at the union they left. Already seeing declining membership, as you mentioned. Obviously a decline in what they can do after Act 10. Now what for them?
Well, I don't know. I know that in speaking to some of the active stewards there and some of the leadership, their plan is to do what they can to begin to reorganize at the base, to insist on the rights that they've got, and to try to mobilize people to say this is what fairness at the job looks like. And I think you're basically in a situation where many people were, including even I was in some years ago, where you had no collective bargaining rights for all practical purposes and had to find other ways of making your point other than through a grievance procedure, whether it's petition or demonstrations or other things that would call attention to your issue and at the same time position it so that everybody can see that issues of fairness is everybody's issue, and hence you put pressure on the administration to do things.
Is the will there to do that? I mean, there were the Capitol protests. There was the recall effort. Really nothing came out of that. There's still Governor Walker, still a Republican majority in the legislature. Act 10 is still there. Is there the will to do those things?
Well, I think there's a difference between what goes on in the workplace and these massive demonstrations. And the workplace thing is always a question because it's always a higher stakes. Got to go to work every day. So I think there's a will. I think it takes a long time for this to materialize. It's easy in a certain sense to go demonstrate. It's another thing to get 5 or 10 of your colleagues and go to your local supervisor and say, you know, the senior employee who's really pretty skilled here should have got that job, not somebody you knew from another department. And I think that's much harder. So I think there's a will, and I think there is a way, but I think it also takes a while for that will and the way to come together because it is difficult, again, to confront one's supervision at your workplace, and it's easier to go demonstrate.
You follow the labor movement in Wisconsin. In general, what's been the reaction since they voted to leave the bigger union?
Well, I think people are very concerned. I mean, clearly, what you're having is, and I don't want to say disintegration, but it's close to it, of the public sector unions. You have a fall in membership somewhere between 60 and 80%, depends where. You have people who for many, many years have worked within a certain system of arbitration, of grievances and whatnot, and that's thrown out the window. And so it's not only the union people, you know, it's also local management who are saying, what do we do here? But I think people are upset. I think certainly people are depressed in some many, many cases. But I also believe that in talking to many people, it's beginning to be clear that the objective here has nothing to do with anything except lowering one's standard of living and, in a sense, reducing democracy in the workplace. Now, having said that, does that mean people are willing to suddenly rise up at the workplace? No. I think those things take quite a while to happen, and usually it's some catalyst that we don't even think of at the moment.
Frank, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That was Frank Emsbach. He's executive producer of Workers Independent News.
Coming up next, NPR music editor Stephen Thompson helps us get a handle on a great summer soundtrack. That's coming up. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we're enjoying summer. I guess we'll probably both, everyone, I speak collectively here, will be enjoying summer a little bit more when the heat breaks. But we've got some music to help us along with the transition.
Yeah, we're going to get some expert help on creating the ideal summer soundtrack.
Stephen Thompson is with us. He's editor and reviewer for NPR Music and a panelist on the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast. Stephen, welcome to Central Time.
It's great to be here. This is my first time on this particular show.
I know, the first of many, I hope.
Yeah.
So you've been listening to lots of tunes. It's your job, but you must have some special stuff that you reserve for summer, right?
Well, absolutely. But, you know, at the same time, there are my songs of the summer, and then there's society's songs of the summer. What we as America as a whole sort of dictate are the songs we will hear over and over and over and over again.
Kind of like the corollary to holiday music.
Yeah, a little bit. You know, I might have a record that I will pull out that's special to me, but that's not necessarily what I'm going to hear over the loudspeaker on Black Friday.
Let's split it up, Stephen. What, for you personally now, is the ingredient for a good summer song?
Well, I think that ubiquity is big, you know, as far as those you know, as far as determining what those collective songs are. And I think that ubiquity plus time equals nostalgia. And so when we talk about the classic summer songs, you know, I kind of was looking through various lists of what were big hits. We actually have a mix up on the NPR music website right now called The Mix, The Songs of the Summer. And what they did was pull kind of the two most popular songs of each summer dating back 50 years. And it's amazing, first of all, how, I mean, they were the biggest selling songs of their whatever summer it was, but it's amazing how powerful and how ubiquitous and how unforgettable most of those songs are, in part because they're seared into our brains, you know, from whatever, probably baked in by the heat from whatever summer they happened in.
Right. And one I think that's baked into everyone's brains is California Girls by the Beach Boys. You know, some of these songs, the funny thing is, I don't even know whether I like them or not anymore, but they do make
they're
me.
They're just there.
They're just there. And they that do make me think about summer.
That is the power of ubiquity.
Well, California Girls, let's listen to a little bit.
I wish they all could be.
Will help sear that into everyone's brains a little bit more. California Girls by the Beach Boys. I don't want to forget, you can join the show at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What's your favorite song of the summer? Either one of these songs that's all over the place or something that you personally really love to listen to in the summer. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Okay, Stephen, you can go off the beaten path a little now. What's one of your favorites to listen to in the summer, even if it isn't burned into all our brains?
Well, for me, summer is the sound of the band Fountains of Wayne. Fountains of Wayne had a big hit about 10 years ago called Stacy's Mom that was a big novelty hit. But they also they write a lot of songs about summer. And to me, the one that stands out is that the perfect roll your windows down. Not that you want to roll your windows down right now because, oh my God, I think it's as hot there. I think it's supposed to be as hot there as it is here. It is like a bayou toilet outside in Washington, D.C. Let's play a little bit of Fountains of Wayne. Do you guys have Radiation Vibe?
I think we do.
We're working on getting that one.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was going to call you on that because you said summer is the time you think of Fountains of Wayne. Don't you just think of Fountains of Wayne in every season? I think every time I've ever talked to you, you mentioned Fountains of Wayne.
You know, that might be. We may have talked about summer songs in the past on various shows as well. Yeah, Fountains of Wayne for me is definitely a go-to band. You know, just kind of a smart, clever band that really knows how to tap into youth and nostalgia.
Well, one that is nostalgic for me, I guess basically because of its association with the Karate Kid, which, you know, call me crazy, I still love the movie Karate Kid. And also I have kids who love the Karate Kid. And so, ergo, I like the song Cruel Summer by Bananarama. Tell us about that one.
Oh, gosh, yeah. I mean, it's interesting. You know, we talked about nostalgia and ubiquity. It's amazing how easy it is, not to call out your age, but how easy it is to pinpoint someone's age based on what their favorite summer song is. And so Bananarama Cruel Summer is, I believe, 1984. And I'm 40 years old, so I was 12. I was 12 when Cruel Summer came out. And it's really a big one. Another one, you know, that I think I might have, you know, thrown out when you and I were discussing this ahead of time was like Rob Bass and DJ Easy Rock, It Takes Two. You know, certain songs that just sound like sizzling concrete.
Here's a little bit of sizzling concrete.
Roll down those car windows just for nostalgia, just for a minute, and then get back in the AC if you can.
Yeah, that brings back memories of theaters, and I hope you're not having people calculating my age as well, Stephen. But
No, you were not yet born.
That's right.
When Cruel Summer was.
I was not even a twinkle.
One thing I love about Cruel Summer, I remember in the video distinctly, they're out and it's capturing how sunbaked and miserable everything is, and they're showing how incredibly high the gas prices are, and that the sign says $1.47.
No.
Top 10 signs, you're old. Yeah.
Exactly.
I like that one. I think that's one that's aged pretty well. I don't know. The Beach Boys, I think, are just the Beach Boys. They stand in the category by themselves. But I feel like Cruel Summer has aged okay.
I think a lot of the songs we're going to talk about today have aged well. I think in part because of nostalgia. There are certain things, if you go a long time without hearing something, or if you hadn't heard it very many times, you hear it now and it's more likely to sound dated. And I think a song like Cruel Summer that's always been kind of seeping into the atmosphere, that's an easier one. It's aged better.
And I'm glad you mentioned riding around in your car, because I was having trouble thinking of like the summer songs of my youth. And when you said driving around in the car, I thought, you know, cruising around the streets of Belleville, Michigan, the mean streets,
nice.
With the band The Outfield.
Oh, sure.
Boston. Mm-hmm. And then a little later on, I heard, I was driving a hot summer. The jazz musician, Cuban-American jazz musician, Paquito de Rivera. I heard this amazing song. It's Cuban, maybe that's why. I cried out summer, and that's what I drove directly to a record store after I heard the announcement on the radio and bought it right away. And that's a classic summer hit for me. I guess nice. They're all car memories for some reason.
Yeah, the car is an incredibly powerful place, and I have found over the years, I've never had a cool car. and so much of the cultural attachment, you know, between cars and music is like you got a convertible and you're looking awesome and it's cherry red and whatever. And I just took a road trip back to Wisconsin actually last week and listened to a ton of music, and I drive a 2005 Chrysler Town and Country with 167,000 miles
on
it.
That's a sweet ride, Stephen.
Just a sweet dad minivan. and yet it's still certain songs sound cool. Cool in even the shabbiest of cars.
Maybe even cooler.
Well,
you mentioned a couple songs earlier that you really liked, and we've got Fountains of Wayne, and that was the one that you especially love. Let's listen to that one.
Nice.
Okay, I could see that for summer. I get where you're coming from, man.
Radiation, yeah. Sun.
But it's bouncy and peppy, too.
It's bouncy and peppy and timeless, and just it's one of those songs where in some alternate universe, it was a gigantic hit. and so to me, it feels very much like a summer song. I like that Veronica pointed out that I probably played it on Wisconsin Public Radio 18 times.
I think you have.
But I get asked before I do these things, pick some of your favorite songs. I'm like, well, there's, you know.
At least you're consistent.
Exactly. Yeah, consistent is the word.
I would be worried if you suggested a whole bunch of Meatloaf songs.
Oh, yeah, we've discussed my hatred of Meatloaf.
We have, right. So he did not show up on your best of summer list.
No paradise by the dashboard light in that car.
Not in mine.
Well, let's see. We've got a couple phone calls here. Let's go to Jeff, who's joining us from La Crosse. Hi, Jeff.
Hi.
Hey, what's your favorite summer song?
Oh, it's got to be Janis Joplin's Summertime.
Mm. Nice.
What do you like about it?
It's just so nice and easy going. You can sit back in the hammock with a beer and just listen to Janis Joplin singing Summertime.
I love that because it's not the bouncy, peppy, driving party song.
Yeah.
It's the lay back on a hot day summer song.
Good way to stay cool.
It's a chill out song.
It's a really good point. You know, it's really easy to think about summer songs as summer anthems, as you know, the summer of the song Dynamite by Teo Cruz or whatever, mm-hmm. or the Black Eyed Peas or whatever. And you think of these like peppy, overdriven songs as the songs of the summer. But a lot of the songs of the summer are barbecue songs. They're hammock songs. And yeah, that's a good point.
Do you have any other along that same line, Stephen, sort of more like chill out songs? I'm trying to relax and take it easy. It's summertime.
Oh, gosh. You know, there's so many different directions I could go with this. You know, I tried to pick something from at least the last five decades, and I picked a couple of songs from the 70s, one very peppy and one so mellow almost too mellow, but I picked Seals and Crofts, the song Summer Breeze.
Seals and Crofts, Summer Breeze. We're going to get that one later, but in the meantime, we do have Summertime from our listener queued up to listen to, the Janis Joplin. Let's take listen.
Summertime, time, time,
take and listen to Janis Joplin's Summertime there as we talk to Stephen Thompson. He's an editor and reviewer for NPR Music and a panelist on the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast. And we're sampling some summertime tunes and hearing some of Stephen's favorites from over the years.
And you can join in with your suggestions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. I think we're going to go out with the B-52s, Love Shack. Our own Laurie Skelton recommended that as a great song. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. We'll let the B-52s play us out.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
And this is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about summer music with Stephen Thompson. He's editor and reviewer for NPR Music, a panelist on the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast. Well, Stephen, Daft Punk there, Get Lucky. Talk about ubiquitous. We were driving through Chicago a few weekends ago. I heard this song on three different stations flipping channels at the same time. I can see why you, why did you put this one on your list?
Well, because of what you just said.
Yeah.
It's absolutely everywhere. I mean, I think this song and Blurred Lines by Robin Thicke are kind of your two clear breakaway songs of this summer where, you know, I'm not sure there actually are other songs right now, as you suggested. And what's interesting, actually, about Get Lucky by Daft Punk as a summer song is it conjures several different eras at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds modern. You've got Pharrell Williams singing on it, but it also has these throwback disco, you know, this kind of disco groove to it that makes it feel old and new at the same time.
All right, let's go to a caller now. We've got John with us from Green Bay. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how about you?
Great. Well, I think you guys are exactly right that summertime songs are definitely an issue of nostalgia, and your conversation of rolling around in the car really brought me back to a summer long ago when freedom, you know, you're out of school and your friend turned 16, they got their driver's license, and finally you can roll around, particularly when gas only costs $1.87 or whatever. and that particular summer, the anthem was Paradise City by Guns N' Roses for my friends and I. I could still see myself in the back seat.
All right, I think Amanda pulled that up. You got it, DJ Amanda? Let's hit it. Oh, I better not sing along there. No good will come of that.
You are ruining my summer.
The show's been canceled 2 minutes later.
I have to say, I am with John on this one. I love this song.
It's a good song.
I don't know why. I can't really, you know, defend Axl Rose's voice or anything else, but I still like it.
Oh, I would mount a staunch defense of this song. And yeah, oh man, great, great summer song.
And talking about the freedom of summer, one from your list that I think we should probably give a listen to, Alice Cooper, School's Out for the Summer. That, I'm guessing that was a must-include list on your summer song list, Stephen?
Yeah, that absolutely had to be there. I mean, it's interesting. My kids, when I was a little kid, I loved Alice Cooper, A, for that song, and B, because he had been on The Muppet Show.
Oh, yeah.
And so I actually dressed as Alice Cooper for Halloween when I was like 7 years old.
Wow.
And when I was picking up my kids on their last day of school this past school year, they were singing this song. Like this song is a permanent beginning of summer song for generation after generation after generation.
And will be for many to come, I'm sure.
And will be for many to come.
I have to introduce my kids to this one, actually. They don't know it yet. Can you believe it?
Oh, man, they didn't hear it in the...
I know.
I'm sure they know all the words to Thrift Shop by Macklemore and Ryan
Lewis.
Actually,
they do know
Hopefully not all the words.
Not all the words, yes. Careful to say.
Yeah. You'd be surprised at how many of the words they probably
know. You know what? I don't even want to know, Stephen. As a parent, I don't want to know. I like that one. So let's go next to Jim joining us from Sockville. Hey, Jim.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. How about you?
I'm well. So this has been a good trip down memory lane. I'm reminded of a lot of favorite songs. I'll be getting the iPad out later.
Oh, yeah.
But
gotta relive it.
My contribution would be Eliot Haynes and Jeremiah's Lakeshore Drive. Definitely a top-down song for driving on Lakeshore Drive on a summer night.
All right. Well, I think we've got that. Yeah, Amanda, go for it. Did I hear that right? Something about being on LSD while driving around on Lakeshore Drive? Do not try this at home, children.
Wisconsin Public Radio does not condone.
Right.
I feel like
let's get legal in here.
You might have misunderstood that,
oh,
Rob.
Lakeshore Drive, LSD, Lakeshore
okay,
Drive.
Okay,
all right.
Okay, gotcha.
I am dumb.
Rob needs to work on his song interpretation, but we'll work on that after the show. What do you think about that one, Stephen?
Well, I mean, it's another one that sounds like a very specific era, and you know, we keep talking about nostalgia. That feels that brings you back to a very specific time and place.
Yeah, it does. It's more that cruising era. Do people still go cruising? Like you said, gas prices are too high to go cruising. Maybe people bike around. I don't know.
Did I mention I drive a 2005 Chrysler Town & Country? I know not of cruising.
Yeah, sorry about that. I can remember, though, there was quite a cruising scene when I was in high school, and it is something I think about just kind of sonically when summer hits and people roll their windows down and you're treated to everyone else's musical taste. Sometimes it's really cool, and other times you're like, maybe December's not so bad after all. It does change the way your world sounds, that's for sure.
Yeah.
We'll get back to the phones. Not too much time left. I don't know if we'll play everybody's selections now, but John, you're with us. John in Antigo. Hi.
How you guys doing? Great show.
Great. What's your summertime music pick?
I don't know. Whenever I hear Sheryl Crow, Soaking Up the Sun reminds me of summer. Mm.
That sounds like a dead-on fit.
Yeah. I like listening to it either down by the dock or just riding around in the car with the air on, especially now.
Yeah, that is a good one. I like that one, too. Steven, you like that one?
Yeah, no, absolutely, and you know, it's great that somebody picked something from the '90s because we were trying to hit every decade. But this is absolutely, yeah, just instant picnic in your mind when you hear it.
We've got one more from your list. I'll be honest, I don't know this one. "Steal My Sunshine" by Len. We'll give a listen.
Yeah. Such a great song. I know it's up.
That's a nice song. I see Chris Molina, who's answering your phone calls, is rocking out in there.
So is Amanda,
he knows it. I guess Rob and I don't, which might be something about our age. I don't know, but I like it. It's a good song.
Yeah, Len is one of those one of many dozens of great '90s one-hit wonders, and it's just oh man, I love that song. I was swaying the entire time you were playing it.
So we should know that song, Rob,
we
if it's
should.
A '90s song.
I tuned out of some of the new music in the '90s. I'll be honest, '80s good. More recently, now that my kids are getting into it, great. '90s, I have some gaps, I'll be honest.
we'll get you caught up. Start
we're
with that.
Filling the gaps.
Well, that's what we're doing here, yeah.
All right, maybe we can take one more call. We have time for one more. Scott in Whitewater. Hi, Scott.
How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Great. If you're sitting on your hammock chair, swinging in the breeze when you play Southern Cross, sometimes you feel the Nash, but you can smell the salt water on the ocean.
Southern Cross by Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and Young. I'm never sure which ones have Young and which ones don't.
Yeah, maybe it's Crosby, maybe it's Steel, but it's one of those guys. It's all about on the ocean, sailing, and a great relaxing barbecue song. You got to dig that one up.
Great. Thanks a lot, Scott, for the recommendation. Crosby, Stills, and Nash. I think there's probably a couple of good summer ones, Stephen.
Oh, yeah, and I love the way when people describe music and they're able to describe tastes and smells in addition and sights, of course, in addition to sound. I mean, that's one of the things that is so incredibly intoxicating about music is that it's technically only triggering one sense, but it's really triggering so many more.
Yeah, they are just like memory capsules, that's for sure. I don't know the song he mentioned, though. Rob, can you sing a few bars?
When you see the Southern Cross for the first time.
Yeah, I still can't place it.
Oh, sure. Should I try it as Neil Young?
Oh, wait. Now I think I got it. Yeah. I did get it.
I, I thought your singing got canceled. Got us canceled right. 10 minutes ago.
Yeah, we see our program director racing by, banging on the door, trying to get in. We locked the studio
CD.
Door.
Yeah, but that reminded me of another good one: Creedence Clearwater Revival, "Looking Out My Back Door." That's just a great back porch song for the summer for me that I hadn't thought of until he triggered it with that.
Yeah, there's so many out there. It makes me want to go update my iPod list. Stephen, if you had to recommend three songs to put on our iPods or whatever, our cassettes,
come up with
our eight tracks.
Out of nowhere. Well, we already played Len. I mean, in terms of summer songs that we were talking about, I mean, it's certainly your It Takes Two by Rob Bass and DJ Easy Rock is just an absolutely perfect late 80s hip hop song that fits the summer perfectly. Recent one, I've probably talked to you, Veronica, about it before, but the song The Only Place by Best Coast, which was my favorite summer song of last year. Just an absolutely perfect song. The Only Place by Best Coast. And, going back to the 60s, how about Hot Fun in the Summertime by Sly and the Family Stone?
There you go.
It could be
better.
That's
a bit of classic, a bit of old, bit of new. I like it.
Yeah.
All right.
You've passed, Stephen. Well
Thank
done,
you
sir.
So much.
You can keep your job at NPR.
I can enter the weekend.
Yes, you can. Well, thanks for the fresh inspiration. It's been a lot of fun, as always.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Stephen Thompson, editor and reviewer for NPR Music and panelist on the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast.
You can keep this conversation going at the Central Time Facebook page. Share your favorite songs of the summer. Coming up next, we've got Noah Ovshinsky. He'll give us the headlines, and then I'll talk to him about the big news in Wisconsin this week, our regular Friday check-in. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And now we'll get some more detail from Noah. It's time for his weekly check-in on the news of the week in Wisconsin.
Noah, thanks for joining us today.
It's good to be here, Rob. Thanks for inviting me back.
Of course. Well, this is a little different than, you know, the big budget weeks we had a little while ago. Not the hottest news in Wisconsin this week.
It's been a relatively, and I say relatively in quotes,
right,
relatively quiet week here in Wisconsin news. A few items of note and some things that do affect people here in the state.
Well, something that's going to be a perennial story for a while, the mining in northern Wisconsin, some new developments there.
Yeah, the legality of a harvest camp that the Lakota Ray have set up near the proposed mining site. There has been some debate this week as far as whether or not they're actually allowed to be there, whether or not they have the proper permits to be there. Now, just as a reminder, this is a camp that was set up not far from the mining, proposed mining site, that is both a harvest and education camp. And it's also been a place where a lot of mine opponents have gathered. And so it's been really one of the sort of, I say, chess pieces in this ongoing story as it relates to mining.
And Mike Simonson was with us yesterday. The short version of what he said was, it's kind of complicated. There's a lot of different agencies with different purviews here, but it's a gray area at best if this site is legal. Did I get that right?
Right, exactly. The Wisconsin County's Forestry Association essentially this week called this harvest camp, called it illegal, saying it did not have the proper permits to be there. And it's unclear whether or not they do have the proper permits to be there. I would say that the Lakota Ray say that they don't actually need those permits anyway. Because they're tribal members and because of the treaties of 1837 and 1842, those treaties actually give them the right to hunt, fish, and gather on public land in the ceded territory, which is where the camp is. And they argue also that, you know, nobody's been denied access to this camp. And that's one of the arguments that the Wisconsin County's Forestry Association has made. They basically say, you know, we're concerned about the legality of this camp because it actually concerns the protection of the public right for access, because where the harvest camp is located, it's county land.
And then what's the next step as far as whoever's keeping track of a permit on this?
Yeah, the Forestry Committee, which initially voted unanimously to approve the harvest camp, they've put it back on their agenda next Tuesday to talk about the legality of this harvest camp.
Now, we haven't been doing this very long, Noah, but it seems like a lot of these stories end with this is probably going to end up in the courts. Is this another one?
You know, I think it's unclear where this is going to end up. I think it will largely be up to county officials to decide how they want to proceed. You know, this harvest camp, you know, it is part of the politicization of this issue, of the mining issue. And like anything related to this mining issue, there are critics and there are supporters. Mm-hmm. And I think depending on where you stand on the mining debate is, generally speaking, where you stand on whether or not this harvest camp should be there or not.
That's a story we're going to keep following. Also this week, you brought to our attention new unemployment rules coming into effect here in Wisconsin.
Right. Starting yesterday, actually, Rob, the state began phasing out sort of the practice of printing the good old-fashioned checks and sending them to people for their unemployment benefits. Those are being phased out. Folks who are just entering the unemployment system now are going to have the option of to get a debit card. Now, these debit cards have been relatively controversial around the country, it remains to be seen how it will be unveiled here. The practice is, as I said, is controversial. It has a mixed record because in some states the bank fees have really added up, and it raises the question: should people who be receiving unemployment, should they have to be paying fees to a bank in order to get their benefits? Now, this is just being introduced in the state, and I think it's way too premature to say that it's inappropriate or wrong that we've moved to a debit card system, mm-hmm. or a partial debit card system. But I think it's something that we have to keep a close eye on because, of course, for people who are on unemployment, many are on a fixed income. And even if it's a $3 fee or a $2 fee, you know, that adds up.
And you say it's just being phased in. If someone is receiving checks now, are they going to see a debit card, I guess, in the mail next week, or are they still going to get the checks for a while?
The people who are receiving checks now, who are already receiving unemployment, will receive checks until their benefits run out. And I would say that the other option for people who are now entering unemployment now will have the option between these debit cards and a direct deposit. So there will be a choice. But it is introducing a practice that has proven to be controversial in other states.
And about how many people are on unemployment in Wisconsin now?
Right now, at last check, I believe there are around 84,000 people on unemployment.
And states are switching to this because, I guess, it's cheaper?
It's cheaper in theory. It is a much more efficient way to get money out there. The theory being it is ultimately cheaper, requires less manpower and fewer dollars.
All right. Now what everyone's waiting for, we've got a race for governor coming up in, just over a year?
Yeah.
Just over a year. Yeah. But we're seeing some rumbling, some reporting on the race. I'm going to go out on a limb and say the Republicans might nominate Scott Walker.
Just might. Yeah,
I'm not putting money on that. But there's some action on the Democratic side. What's going on?
Yeah. I'd say, we're just starting now to see some of our first reporting on the next governor's race as far as it relates to the Democrats. State Senator Kathleen Vinehout, who was considering a run in 2014, mm-hmm. And who also ran in the recall, told WPR earlier this week that she may not jump in the race if Mary Burke ran. Now, just as a reminder, Mary Burke is a former Trek Bicycle executive, and her name has been floating around as a possible candidate for the Democrats. There's been some polling out there that have asked the public about Mary Burke. And so it's very interesting to see, where these well-known politicians, where they're falling as far as it relates to the primary. State Firefighter Union President Malin Mitchell, mm-hmm. who also ran for the lieutenant governor position during the recall, who is also somebody who has said that he's thinking about running on the Democratic ticket, has also said that, a Mary Burke candidacy would affect his decision.
Now, why? Why are people watching what she's doing? A political outsider for the most part. Why are they keeping such a close eye on her?
I think there are two reasons, Rob. I think one is she's got deep pockets. She's a former executive and has some money, has some wealth. And of course, that, comes in handy for a lot of politicians who are looking to campaign, especially one that's a statewide campaign. And she also has private sector experience, which I think is going to prove to be a compelling narrative if she runs. it will be a compelling narrative for the Democrats in 2014 because, of course, they'll be running against Governor Walker, who himself ran initially on the promise of providing jobs. And so I think a private sector candidate, I think, would be very compelling, at least for the Democrats.
One of the first mentions I heard about Mary Burke running for governor was an email from the state Republican Party saying, hey, she's doing these polls, and they were already trying to sow some doubts about her. Other Democrats are worried about running against her. I know it's too soon to tell,
yeah.
But is there a sense that Republicans might say this private sector candidate or someone like her could be a challenge?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think it'll be interesting to see whoever the candidate ends up being. You know, the one thing that both Malin Mitchell and Kathleen Vinehout told WPR was that they want to avoid a bruising primary, that would be the worst thing for the Democratic Party in Wisconsin, that it would take away momentum, it would take away money, and it would distract from the job of trying to, replace Governor Walker. And so I think you're going to see a group of people who are going to hold off from going public with their decision as to far as whether or not they're going to run, because whoever announces is going to have a big target on their back. And I think the longer they wait, the less likely there will be that they'll have, ads that the Republican Party, Governor Walker, there'll be a fewer chance that those ads will hit the air and start attacking them early.
It's a taste of things to come for the next, 16 months or so?
Yeah. Yeah.
And now also looking ahead, we've been running our series, the WPR News series on heroin in Wisconsin. We finished that up on Monday. What are we looking ahead to there?
Yeah. On Monday, the final piece in our series on the growing heroin epidemic here in the state, it is drug courts. Gilman Halstead tackles the issue of drug courts and the success that they're having at getting a large number of heroin addicts to kick the habit and also, perhaps most importantly, keeping them out of prison. And so that's going to sort of bookend our series. We've talked about the epidemic as it relates to, law enforcement, how it's been treated by counties and cities. We've talked about the different medicines that are used to prevent a deadly overdose. And now we're ending the series with a discussion about, what happens to addicts, how do we get them off the drugs and how do we keep them out of prisons?
Hey, if anybody missed any of that, I bet they could go to the WPR News website.
Absolutely. WPRnews.org will have, in fact, we already do, have all of our stories other than Gill's online right now. And I'd really urge people who want to get a sense of where this epidemic is going in the state to go there, listen to these stories, look at the graphs on the web, because I think the graphs that we have up there are very compelling and tell a real story and a discouraging story about where heroin is going in the state.
Noah, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That was Noah Ovshinsky, WPR's assistant news director.
He joins us each week at this time to bring us up to date on the news of Wisconsin. Well, coming up, we're going to talk about movie trailers. Let me take a stab at it. In a world where movie producers are struggling to capture your attention. All right, that's all I got.
Was that your Don LaFontaine?
If only. If only.
It's a nice shot, though.
Yeah, but we're going to talk about how movie trailers have changed over the years from the 50s and 60s up to the modern day, the fast, frenetic, attention-getting thing.
All the edits,
yeah.
All the fast pace, the pathos, the drama.
I watched 3 to 8 of those, and I forget what movie I actually came to see. That's coming up after the news.
We'll find out why sometimes the trailer is better than the movie. And looking back on some comments we've gotten on Facebook about our music segment.
The conversation's still going, yeah.
So Scott on Facebook said, "Atmosphere Sunshine, it's both a story of victory and a celebration of outdoors."
Maddie on Facebook has a summer song, "Night Moves" by Bob Seger. He says, "But beware, students and teachers, don't listen to it too soon to the end of summer, because the line, with autumn closing in, is absolutely haunting."
And John on Facebook loves "Summer in the City" by The Lovin' Spoonful. So thanks for keeping the conversation going. I'm Veronica Rickert.
I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time
on the Ideas Network.